Welcome to New Books in Media and Communications, part of the New Books Network of podcasts, featuring discussions with scholars on all forms of media content and technology. I'm your host, John Baltz, a marketing and advertising professional. Our website is newbooksandcommunications.com, where you can find a short summary of the book discussed on today's show, as well as our archives, where you can listen to past conversations. You can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. If you like us, please tell a friend or leave a review. Your feedback helps us have better conversations with authors. Today's guest is journalism professor Josh Braun, who is the author of This Program is Brought to You By, Distributing Television News Online, published in 2015 by Yale University Press. Josh spent time getting an inside look at MSNBC between 2007 and 2012, a time when the company was consolidating the brands of its television network and online news hub and rolling out new technologies internally like blogs, video players, and community forums that could support viewer and visitor demands. The solution to these challenges was not imposed through smooth, top-down, hierarchical decision-making, but rather through a messy internal process involving multiple players with competing objectives. The book's title, This Program is Brought to You By, has the familiar ring of an advertiser supporting a piece of television content. But the book's intent is to shift the focus back to the people inside MSNBC who, quite literally, brought the programs to you. The conversation lasts about an hour. I hope you enjoy it. Today's guest is Josh Braun, an assistant professor of journalism studies in the journalism department at University of Massachusetts Amherst. His research centers around online media distribution, looking at the nuts and bolts of online television distribution and web development as a sociological phenomenon, sort of like the development of power grids or highways. Josh, welcome to the New Books in Media and Communications podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, near the end of the book, you write a short mock news story summarizing the period of research. I'm going to quote it here. MSNBC.com was one of the first mainstream media organizations to invest heavily in social networking, acquiring Newsvine in 2007. In 2010, further recognizing the commercial importance of the social web, MSNBC.com fully integrated Newsvine's community features into its primary domain, demonstrating its commitment to the enterprise by pilot testing its new community blogging software with one of MSNBC's TV flagship primetime programs, The Rachel Maddow Show, and subsequently releasing the platform across the whole of the Blue site. This is a 100% factually accurate assessment, correct? And if so, why isn't it the story?
Yeah, so that is sort of how things would have appeared from the outside if you were talking about what was going on at MSNBC in the period leading up to 2011 or so. And so the trick is, and sort of what the book kind of gets at, is that MSNBC is a brand, is kind of a unified entity if you're looking at it as the public, but internally it's actually not even just one company, but several companies that had acquired different smaller organizations, had lots of different editorial staffs and show teams working on different properties. And sort of one of the points that the book makes is that and this is not unusual for sort of large contemporary media organizations, is that what appears as kind of a unified thing from the outside is actually kind of full of different moving parts and editorial subcultures internally. And so what was going on sort of behind the scenes is that you had all of these different teams. You had Newsvine, which you just kind of briefly described. It was this social media startup that ended up providing many of the community features and even sort of some central parts of the content management software for MSNBC.com and for the sort of web presence of the cable channels. Different programs, but it had sort of started out as a social network that was, news themed, but, you know, akin to Dig or Reddit or something like this. And its integration into, MSNBC.com, and the sort of larger MSNBC brand, meant that it was sort of pursuing multiple, goals at once. It was trying to keep its social media platform running. At the same time, it was sort of serving as a development team, for this broader collection of properties. And then on the television side, you had a bunch of different programs that sort of were kind of being, shoehorned into a pretty, common, web presence, or sort of an identical template for each of the different shows. And you had individual programs within that, like the Rachel Maddow Show, which figures large in the book, who weren't necessarily happy with the web template they'd been given. And so they, at the same time, were kind of pursuing their own trajectory of getting a web presence that they were happy with. And so they went out looking for a tool to start a blog with. And there was a lot of sort of internal negotiation about using the new, or whether the Newsvine tool would be the one that they used, and ultimately, like, sort of how fast it could be pressed into service. And so ultimately, I guess the way that I would kind of summarize all this, because it's a complicated story that takes the bulk of the book to tell. But it's this notion that a lot of the time, sort of change, whether it's sort of like change in infrastructure or change in strategy, for distribution, oftentimes within a large media organization will sort of move forward by different groups asking for forgiveness rather than permission. And so you had a lot of people kind of pursuing their own provincial goals in different ways. And it kind of realigned the way all the resources, within MSNBC, were being utilized, and resulted in a pretty, like, dramatically different, online distribution strategy for the entire, organization or set of organizations.
I'd like to come back to some of the broader themes of the book a little later, but I want to dig in here on a couple of things. One, the point in time at which this research that you're undertaking is 2010.
That's right. Yeah, that was when the primary field work for the book was done.
So why is a blogging platform or blogging software so difficult to get done in 2010?
Right. And so this is actually, you know, again, it's sort of, you could tell different stories about this, so from the outside, it might seem pretty ridiculous, as you're saying, in 2010, why is it so hard to get a blog done? But if you look at what actually happened at MSNBC.com, which also I should mention here, MSNBC.com ran the web presence both for the MSNBC cable channel, but also for NBC News and all the sort of like programs like the Nightly News or the Today Show, and things of that nature, as well as a bunch of sort of online only destinations and properties. And they had, you know, and so there's a lot of, over the years, there's been a lot of finger pointing when it comes to so-called legacy media organizations and how they might have been slow to adopt different digital tools and distribution strategies. And this might initially seem like another example of that. But in fact, MSNBC.com and NBC more broadly, they were actually pretty early. They were sort of ahead of the curve on this with regard to sort of large, at least large television news organizations. And they started a lot of blogs early. And those early efforts were sort of, were kind of highly experimental. They put them on different platforms over time. So the very first ones out of the gate would have been using something like Typepad, like Six Apart's tool. And then when they decided that they wanted to standardize on something, they used another really kind of early entrant, the community server platform, community server was this company that provided sort of integrated blogs and forum tools to sort of set up, as the name suggests, the different tools that you might need to sort of host an online community and publish a blog and other sort of online content. And so they used those tools very early on. I think I would need to check the dates, but I want to say this goes back to like 2005 or 2005, 2006, when these initial efforts are being started. And so what you ended up with a few years later is them wanting to kind of upgrade this the software platform, but in the process, they have to then move the blogs that are hosted in all these different tools onto a new common platform that sort of has more contemporary affordances and a nicer look than, say, community server, or the sort of older Typepad blogs that they had. And doing that, kind of migrating from a bunch of different blogging tools onto a single new platform, and especially one that they would they hoped would be kind of forward-looking and easy to sort of iterate on, turned out to be a pretty involved process of moving different databases around. And the other sort of aspect of this is that at the same time that they were doing that, the whole site was getting a facelift and sort of an infrastructural upgrade. And so you not only had to upgrade the blogging tool, you also had to make sure that sort of it would hang well with the like new visual identity of the rest of the site, which was tied to a separate sort of infrastructure upgrade. So basically, you had a lot of different properties that with a lot of different kind of legacy publishing platforms that had all had to be kind of upgraded and standardized at the same time, and that made for kind of a quite a big task. And then there's details about different development strategies and stuff like that the book gets into. But it turns out that it's pretty difficult to just sort of throw a switch and move everybody over to a new software tool if you want to preserve your archives and serve all the different types of groups that, again, are all kind of are working toward their own goals within a large organization like this.
And did Rachel Maddow and her show and team have some of the strongest incentives for pushing towards this new blogging platform, or sort of why is that show unique in terms of moving this forward?
Yeah, so Rachel Maddow, even before she came to MSNBC, was very popular online and really heavily pursued sort of the web as a medium for both distributing her content and also just interacting with audiences and whatnot. And so she sort of was really kind of pushed the web as sort of part of her personal brand, even before it became a show and sort of a brand affiliated with MSNBC. And so when she came in to MSNBC TV, one of the things that they really wanted was to sort of have this active web presence, and in particular to have a blog that would kind of serve as a hub for all of their different social media efforts, and would also kind of be part of the lefty blogosphere that people are, that will often be familiar with or point to. So this was sort of a big part of kind of the way that she, sort of envisioned her editorial process and everything else. And so when she comes in, she's coming in a little bit late into the process, where all these other shows have kind of fairly static templates, because in many cases they had not, although the web became a much bigger thing with regard to television, a lot of the programs had not been that interested in contributing to it previously. It was enough of a job to put just regular television programs online. A web presence for TV meant something different a few years ago, because before broadband penetration, it was pretty difficult to get like video to people in the first place. So basically, she was a lot more interested in having a large interactive web presence than, until the very recent past, a lot of the other sort of television programs had been. So it was pretty important to her and to her staff to have something that was highly interactive that they could use to sort of publish content on a frequent basis, and that would kind of have the real affordances of a contemporary blog in terms of like being able to link between link to other sources very easily and kind of be updated very simply, and just the simple kind of reverse chronological format of a blog. They wanted that feel if not informality may not be the right word, but that was certainly what they were going for at the time, is sort of a relatively informal web presence that made what would normally have been just kind of a broadcast program feel a little bit more interactive and accessible to audiences.
I mean, she tells you an interesting comment that quite early, she realized that MSNBC.com was not our website. Mm-hmm. How did you interpret what that statement means?
Right. So basically, when like as I mentioned briefly before, all the different templates for the programs on MSNBC.com and NBC were basically video players with a place to add some headlines and links. And there were a few blogs, but they were attached to the older software, which they were in the process of jettisoning when Rachel Maddow started at MSNBC. And so she was very kind of unhappy with the constraints of that sort of template, and was unhappy with the idea that it was going to be sort of the primary web page of the site. Wanted a lot more interactivity and a lot more ability to do stuff. And the other kind of aspect of this is that MSNBC TV and MSNBC.com are actually, or were, I should say, because the corporate ownership structure has changed since the time period described in the book, but they were separate companies. There were these joint ventures that were originally a single joint venture between NBC Television or NBC Universal on the one hand and Microsoft on the other, to create this sort of co-branded property that was going to exist on television and on the web. But over time, NBC became more interested in sort of managing its own kind of television programming, and they didn't necessarily want Microsoft's involvement in what was going on the TV side. And to be fair, Microsoft was never really all that involved to begin with. And meanwhile, sort of Microsoft felt like it was, you know, they were. They also kind of wanted some separation from what was going on in terms of like producing television and whatnot. So the two companies split, and so NBC News was basically, and NBC Universal were the proprietors of MSNBC Television. Meanwhile, Microsoft had its own MSNBC.com website, and which it was also sort of its own company, and that they continued to share ownership of with NBC Universal, but it was a separate sort of corporate entity at that point. And when you looked at what MSNBC.com, the website, looked like versus what MSNBC Television looked like, there were two very different things. So MSNBC.com, the website, grew out of a period when the idea of the brand was still to present neutral point of view news, to sort of like a classic objective news stories, whereas MSNBC Television had made a shift to sort of what you would call like op-ed programming. So some people point to it as being sort of the liberal version of Fox News or something along those lines. The story about kind of how they ended up where they are in terms of the political spectrum is a little bit more complex than just wanting to be sort of a straight up counterweight to Fox or something like that. But ultimately, like the upshot of all of this is that the programming on MSNBC Television, particularly in primetime, carried a very sort of particular political bent. And the stuff on the website was very neutral. And the people who edited the website were interested in sort of not having a kind of cross contamination of brand images, so they didn't want a bunch of opinionated content on their front page, and so they siloed a lot of the television content off to small like parts of kind of small like sort of backwaters of the site that they called like microsites and whatnot, and so this made sense from to them for a variety of perspectives. One was that the sort of MSNBC.com was doing an enormous amount of traffic. So, you know, they were consistently, within like the top five U.S. news websites in terms of the amount of traffic that they were pulling in. And so they were doing quite well as sort of a neutral point of view website. And particularly during the time when MSNBC was doing poorly in the ratings, the television side was doing poorly in the ratings, there was not particularly a huge incentive to plaster like sort of MSNBC television content all over the front page when they were doing well as they were. And then the last sort of thing that affects this is also kind of the temporal difference between like television and the web, right? So particularly when you're talking about prime time programming, it comes on in the evening, and which is typically not the best time of the day when you're talking about web traffic. So most news websites do the bulk of their traffic during daytime hours when people are checking the news from their desks and so forth. Basically putting up last night's newscast on your, or promoting it heavily on your front page, kind of does a disservice to your traffic numbers when you're trying to compete with like the NewYorkTimes.com or Huffington Post or things like that, that are kind of putting up the latest kind of hourly headlines. So there were a huge number of kind of reasons, some of which are unique to MSNBC and others which are quite common across different the web presence for different television news sites. Or the web presence for different television news programs, they kind of relegated like the Matto programs and all of the cable networks content to less highly promoted portions of the site. And so all of those things kind of led to dissatisfaction on the part of people who wanted to really push for an active web presence for television programs.
But correct me if I'm wrong here, though, but on this tension or just a difference or whatever it is between television, what's happening on the MSNBC television side and what's happening on the MSNBC.com side, part of the reason that someone like Rachel Maddow would be able to push for new tools, new capabilities, new staff members, as you point out, would be on the web, would be precisely because of the success that she has in the legacy platform of television.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's certainly true. Within just a few months of her coming in at MSNBC.com as sort of a regular host, she had previously been a guest, and I think occasionally, I can't remember if this is correct, but occasionally maybe a substitute host for Keith Olbermann, but at least a prominent guest on his program. But when she got her own show, within a matter of months, she had doubled the cable channel's ratings in her time slot. Basically, she becomes a really powerful kind of celebrity and force within the television network because of the sorts of ratings she's drawing, she's helping to consolidate this kind of left of center brand. So there's all these reasons why she's becomes very quickly a major part of the television or the sort of television channels branding. And at the same time, so if you look at other kind of programs that MSNBC had, like sort of, for example, Hardball. So there's Hardball with Chris Matthews, right? So which you could imagine a world in which, Chris Matthews has to take some time off or decides to retire or something along those lines. And Hardball with Chris Matthews becomes, Hardball with somebody else. Whereas the Rachel Maddow show is, you have a situation where the program is, and the brand of that program is largely synonymous with the host. Her success at television, yes, gave her an enormous amount of influence. It gave her a contract probably made things easier for her to exert influence when it came to to sort of moving things around. And even though MSNBC.com and MSNBC TV were, as I pointed out, you know, separate companies, MSNBC.com, you know, still had the exclusive rights to distribute the cable channel's television programming. And as the ratings got better for that, and as sort of broadband penetration picked up and people like, and more people started watching more and more video content online, it became a pretty, you know, it became a much better sort of proposition to have a really active web presence for these programs. And so from their perspective as well. And so so they may not have, you know, sort of gone about it as quickly as someone like Matto would have liked. But at the same time, you know, they had a lot of incentive to make her happy because she was sort of, because of her success at television, she also promised to bring a lot of traffic to whatever the web presence for her program was going to be.
So zooming back a bit, within MSNBC, you have obviously all of these different teams at different levels. You have individual shows and their teams like the Rachel Maddow Show or the Hardball Show. You, of course, have the technology teams like Newsvine who are developing the platforms or the software that are used internally. You have the management. They're all over. And you refer to this sort of organizational structure today as post-bureaucratic, where it's essentially project-based management, as you call it, that comes together and for the purpose of accomplishing a task. And then after that task is done, the teams, whatever groups of teams came together, disperse, and then a new set comes together for a new task. I just want to make something clear. You're not making any claims about whether this is a structure unique in media companies, are you?
No, although it is pretty common in media companies. So if you look at people who've written a lot about sort of organizational structures and cultures, you know, there is an argument that this is particularly common among media companies that are at least in the kind of new media environment. But if you look at somebody like David Starks is kind of an organizational sociologist who's advanced a lot of this kind of research, and so he he compares what's going on. He points out that this kind of complex organizational structure is cropping up all over the place, whether it's in the media in particular or in companies in former Soviet bloc countries. So, you know, who are trading commodities and things like that. So there's all sorts of different places where you get these kind of increasingly complex organizational structures, but certainly media is an area where they're increasingly common. So
I'm also trying to think of other industries or settings where it might be more common, or sort of what prompts it. Sort of where does it come from? I mean, I'm thinking like, look, in my own professional field, of every advertising agency I've ever worked for. Is exactly like this. And frankly, when I think about some technology companies that I've been a part of, again, this same notion of a project-based management system is everywhere. I mean, we call it cross-functional teams or whatnot. But I'm trying to think, is the technology piece sort of what's driving this cross-functionality, or is it something else?
Right. So the technology piece is a big one. The word driving is a tricky one, right? And so you basically hit on like one of the major, sort of, I won't call it a debate, but one of the major touchstones of scholarship on technology broadly and media technologies in particular, which is this notion of sort of what some people call material agency, or the extent to which technologies kind of make us do stuff versus the extent to which we kind of control the design and development of technologies, right? So I know you've worked with this, we've looked at Nudge and things like like this. So you're very familiar with this sort of debate. But yeah, this idea that sort of, do our phones make us distractible? Or is it something about the way that we use our phones? Or is it something about the way, about the culture that we live in that designs phones like this, or something along that? So you can have all sorts of different versions of this argument. But certainly, but whatever kind of stance you take, there's certainly a big shift in the way that we handle technologies as a culture. So if you look at somebody like Thomas Hughes, who was a historian of technology, and he wrote about some of the things that you mentioned in the introduction, like power grids and missile defense systems and things like this. One of the arguments that he makes is that there was this shift over the course of the 20th century in the way that we thought about the large kind of technological infrastructures that we built. That we moved from kind of thinking about them as sort of one and done projects, right? Where it's sort of the goal is to build something lasting and enduring, like a railroad or a power grid or something like that was going to, or a dam that was going to serve humanity for, decades or centuries or something like that, right? People were thinking in these kind of grand terms of their legacy. And now we are in a situation where technological development if frequently kind of centers around the notion of disruption, where everything is going to be temporary, everything is going to be iterated on, and the sort of goal of technologies is to upset whatever the last thing was. So basically, Hughes basically said that we kind of lived through this period where the way technologies are designed and the goal sort of behind their design went from sort of creating these enduring things to basically an environment where kind of perpetual change is sort of the assumption. And so that creates a different, if you're thinking in that way, you have different sort of management structures that go along with that, that are much more kind of based around and kind of more iterative strategy or whatnot. And so he points to sort of he points to projects like the development of the internet, which ended up being kind of pretty egalitarian and less top down than in many ways more of the kind of government managed things that had gone before. And so there's that aspect of it, and certainly, like, if you point to sort of the affordances, the abilities that technology gives you in a contemporary media environment, that's also a pretty interesting thing to look at. So if you think about you might have designed something like an ad campaign or a new website or something along those lines previously, although a new website is not the optimal example, right? So let's go for something that's sort of, let's go for an ad campaign sort of pre-digital media, where you might have had a few meetings with the clients and then people kind of go behind closed doors, and you had some relatively hierarchical division of labor between, like, people who were the creatives and the people who did sales and all this stuff. And at the end, you kind of churn out a product that sort of is the result of more or less hierarchical management system. Nowadays, when we are thinking about sort of web design, when we're thinking about media campaigns in a digital era, what's more often happening is that everybody's sort of updating their products at the same time through a service like GitHub, or just putting them on the same internal server, and everybody at the organization can kind of see what's happening all at once, right? And so you can see what the design team is doing in real time when you're on the team that's writing sort of the infrastructural code and things like that. And so you have more of a system in which lots of different people are interacting to a lot, are reacting to the decisions of a lot of other teams in real time, as opposed to a system where something kind of gets handed from underling to manager to top manager and down to the people in another department or whatnot. So kind of information and travels much more kind of horizontally within organizations now. And so there are people who would argue that kind of is is also fostering these kinds of like kind of different organizational structures. And, you know, and so, and the last kind of thing that I would mention, which also goes back to this idea of kind of continually, continually changing media landscape or continually changing sort of like sort of technological environment as well, where you have not just sort of new technologies on a regular basis, but people experimenting with new business models and things like that in a rapid fashion. Is, you know, so David Stark and other kind of organizational scholars highlight the idea that sort of if you do have a company that has a bunch of different teams that have their own, that all have their own kind of provincial logics for working and their own provincial ways of valuing work products, it's almost like having like genetic diversity when you have some kind of cataclysmic event. The species that have a bunch of different variations in terms of the attributes that they have are more likely there's more likely to be something in the gene pool that survives. And so there's an argument that this way of doing things is, you know, while it can look really chaotic, is actually, you know, pretty productive in a sense. Because it sort of it means that you, whatever comes your way, there's likely someone or some team within your organization that is well suited to deal with it. So that's another kind of theme amongst all this. Yeah, and I guess the last. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
So the point about the iterative nature of so much of work, and I guess sort of the permanent impermanence. Is an interesting one. I mean, as you started with the ad campaign example, or again, another media example, you could imagine 50 years ago or whatnot, you bring a bunch of people together and they're a cross-functional bunch of people, but they're acting in a bureaucratic way. Mm-hmm. And what you're saying is this is different than simply a diverse group of people coming together to work. It's about the work process itself.
Right. And I think, and one important point to make is that the fact that we have these sort of more project-based and kind of and horizontally organized structures for work now does not mean that traditional hierarchies have disappeared either. Mm-hmm. So Charlie Tillingist, who is the head of MSNBC.com during my time there, was one of the things that he argued, and he had a very kind of like strong set of views on this, was that you need both within an organization. And so he called it the difference between ownership and innovation, was his take on it, and which was the idea that sort of there's sort of an organizational cost to just managing infrastructure, right? To having having a bunch of servers that need to be always on, and having a bunch of low level code and database management that needs to be running optimally, and that's not necessarily where you're going to be sort of, you know, breaking things and reinventing the wheel every few weeks, right? So, and that kind of infrastructure, that part of the sort of the organization, you know, he thought, well, you could probably manage that very kind of hierarchically, right? That's sort of the ownership and part of this. Whereas when it came to sort of stuff like innovation, like spinning up a big new website, like the website that became the today.com, which was sort of a spinoff website, the Today Show, or something like MSNBC.com's like video player redesign, things like that, where you're inventing something new, or you're trying to create a product that's going to require input from lots of different teams and be sort of an interdisciplinary project within your organization, then you need sort of like more of these kind of like project based cross functional teams, sort of so hierarchic or post bureaucratic, whatever term you like, and so basically you kind of have to have both together. So it's not necessarily an either or, but a both and situation a lot of the time. And so you can see this even at like sort of even at kind of born and bred digital media organizations like Google, where, you know, people have talked about the fact that yes, they have all of these sort of, they have all of the kind of sort of permissive management of a lot of parts of their company, but then you also have the people who have kind of like second class contracts and come into a building at the corner of the parking lot or somewhere and scan books for the book scanning project, right? And so there's these different so even within sort of companies that sort of pride themselves on having very different or very kind of new age structures of management, there's still going to be areas that are much more kind of hierarchically organized than others.
Another piece of this is a small piece, but I found this quite interesting. So in a lot of my work, branding is a dominant issue, and you touch on that, obviously, with MSNBC.com and MSNBC TV. You just touch on it with, you know, the Today Show and spinning that off. Branding a dominant issue. I spent a lot of time talking about the brand in each piece of work, and it's created. And with the caveat that all media properties are essentially brands to some extent. You end up quoting an employee who makes, I think, a very sharp observation about why the Today Show and Nightly News, which are both flagship television programs for NBC. Mm-hmm. But online, the Today Show is a strong brand and Nightly News is barely a brand at all. Mm-hmm. What is that distinction online between why one's a brand and one's not?
Right. So there's a few different factors that play into this. And one of them is sort of the temporal thing that I mentioned before, right? When you have the nightly news broadcast, if you want to put up a clip of that, at the time that people are actually going to come in and view it, which is during daytime hours, it's going to be, you know, over 10 hours old by the time people get to it. And so it's not a great sort of competitive piece in that way. There's also another aspect of this is the amount of programming that's produced, right? So the nightly news produces 22 minutes of programming an evening. I think now it's down to like 18 or something like that, if I remember correctly. And so it produces just a vanishingly small amount of programming compared to the Today Show, which is was on for hours. So the Today Show programming is also being produced during daytime hours, right? At the time when you want fresh content on the site. So you have a lot more video content. It's being produced at a time when it's easy to promote. You have just the names of the programming, where one is called the Nightly News, which during daytime hours is not going to really immediately ring bells when you think to like what's late and breaking. And then to top it all off, there's also this sort of different demographics that you're talking about. So one of the reasons that Today.com was very successful, it was the fact that sort of, I think it's like the demographic that they were aiming at was like sort of women ages, I think 25 to 34 or somewhere in there. So, who are, you know, a demographic that's insanely attractive to advertisers. There's that, part of it, where sort of it's that group is much easier to sell into, like when you're like thinking about kind of selling eyeballs. And then the last kind of piece of it is that even when you zoom in on sort of what are the online behaviors of that particular group, it turns out that women in that particular demographic consume more online video than a lot of other demographics. So not only do you have more stuff to put up, even if we're the amount of video apples to apples, you have a demographic that's going to watch more of the stuff than the demographic that watches that would be watching nightly news online. And so there's a lot of different things that sort of privilege that particular the privilege that Today Show as a brand online, whereas nightly news, which is NBC's sort of flagship property on the air, doesn't necessarily make as great of an online brand.
Right.
Excuse me. And then of course you had like Meet the Press, which, makes content once a week. And I think during my time there, I was, David Gregory actually had his own independently managed website. You can imagine, like, I never had a chance. I didn't talk to anybody about that, or I didn't talk to many of the people who were involved in that program. I did talk to some of them, but you can imagine that probably, for somebody trying to promote that program, it would have created a situation where it's like a lot of incentive to create your own website dedicated to it or something along those lines.
Yeah. And it's a great point about that brands. I think we so often assume, well, it's about, the associations, the intangible qualities, the personality associated with what we think that that's what it is. But yes, but to the it's only valuable and only powerful to the extent that permeates out.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. And nightly news doesn't permeate out enough.
Right.
To be strong, at least particularly in a digital age. I think that's it's a fascinating point. And I think an important one, at least, not necessarily, I don't know, in scholarship, but certainly in the practical side. I want to shift a little bit. You did the field work at MSNBC.
Mm-hmm.
If you could embed yourself today in any media company, free will, no questions asked, ask anything you want, go anywhere you want, where would you go today?
Oh, geez. Well, I think there's like maybe three places that I would love to explore. One would be, so CBS has its online only, like sort of streaming, arrangement, CBSN, which is basically sort of, it's almost like a cable news network or something like that, but its primary home is online. And that's kind of a fascinating, initiative that they've put together. There's also, in the book, I have this kind of fascination with these infrastructure providers, like the companies that produce a lot of the software, produce a lot of, like, create things like cloud services or stuff like that, but don't actually, their name doesn't actually appear anywhere on stuff. And so a company like MLB Advanced Media, which sort of does the infrastructure, they do the infrastructure for obviously Major League Baseball's like MLB TV and that package and whatnot. But they also sell it as a white label product to all sorts of other people. So if you're watching like a number of sort of cable channels, for example, if you're watching their content online, it's coming to you through the infrastructure of MLB Advanced Media. There's been talk of even spinning that operation off, so it's no longer part of Major League Baseball because it's such a big sort of cash cow in and of itself, sort of like Amazon Web Services or something like that, where the side business just becomes a huge a massive part of what you do. And the last one that I would kind of mention, and this is kind of an oddball one, but I think it'd be interesting to do something like NASA television, which is sort of like NASA has run its own television channel that's sort of had pretty poor pickup from cable operations and stuff like that, over the years. But it's kind of been this fascinating kind of public affairs and public relations arm of NASA for years and years. And nowadays, now that it's online, I mean, it does actually get these spikes where people tune into it, right? So if the Mars landing is coming up and you want to live stream stream of it. You know, that's going to come from NASA television. And so, you know, that's the website that you end up on. But I think it's kind of interesting because it's basically an entirely public domain, channel. And so if you think about sort of the debates that happen around media and the copyright wars and all this other stuff, a lot of what we're talking about is the role of people protecting their intellectual property. And we're also interested in the future of public broadcasting. Well, but even PBS, like, their stuff is copyrighted, it's licensed and all this stuff. Here you have this sort of public broadcaster, who's running all public domain content. And I think it's kind of an interesting counterpoint, in those arguments. And who wouldn't want to study an infrastructure that brings images back from Pluto, right? Like, that's kind of a neat thing. So I think those are kind of three of the places where I'm really fascinated by that it would be fun to look at in the future.
Are there historical organizations or moments at which you also think about, wow, those were quite interesting or pivotal?
Yeah, so early cable television before it was back when it was community antenna television. Mm-hmm. So basically places like Ithaca, New York, where I lived for a while, I had all these hills. It was really difficult to get over the air broadcast signals. And so what they would do is they would basically just build these massive antennas or an array of antennas. And the community would all go in and pay for this huge antenna they would pick up for miles around, and they would string string along antenna cable from it to everybody's house. And those early community antenna television networks ended up becoming like the early cable providers and stuff like that. And so that was kind of a transformative moment. If you go back and look at some of the press coverage from when that was happening, a lot of the same debates that sort of continue that crop up today about sort of like, is this some kind of like copyright infringement where basically, they're selling subscriptions to these antenna networks, and are they reselling freely broadcast over the air content? Are they like basically pirating our intellectual property? All these types of things. So that's kind of an interesting moment. And there's also just like, there's work by other people, that I admire that I wouldn't necessarily, know enough to replicate at this moment, but it's kind of inspirational. So like, somebody like McMillian, did a book called Smoking Typewriters, where he talks about the 60s underground press and the syndication networks that they set up to sort of distribute accounts by ordinary individuals to underground papers across the country. And then Richard John has done amazing sort of historical work on like the postal service and the telegraph and telephone and all these different communication infrastructures and stuff like that. So there's a lot of really cool historical examples out there, things that are really neat. And in some ways, we know more about there are more people studying kind of some of the way back distribution infrastructures like the telephone or the telegraph than there are studying kind of contemporary distribution as such. You have a lot of people interested in new media, but not as many people who think of it as distribution in a way that you can kind of contextualize it historically in that way.
The cover of this book is a historical. The image on the cover of this book is a historical one. It's certainly not, I wouldn't call it web focused. All right. It's an Indian head test card from post World War II era following. I had no idea what it was. Had to look it up. Where essentially the sign off that a station would put on the screen after programming ends in a world where programming ended at one point.
Right.
Mm-hmm. How did that end up on a book about web development?
Well, so as with the stuff that I studied, part of it had to do with fun ideas, and part of it was just practical nuts and bolts stuff. So on the one hand, I've always been kind of fascinated with this image, a professor I had at during grad school used to talk about when television was a new thing, people would be so fascinated just by the phenomenon of it that when the programs went off the air, they would just sit for a while and watch the test pattern, right? And he used to joke about like the very short span of time in when you went from that to like sort of the, you know, like just game shows, right? And so he's like, you know, we have this very short span in which people went from sort of what hath God wrought to the $64,000 question was the way that he phrased it. And so I think it's interesting. Like it was this moment in which distribution was kind of a part of culture and a fascinating kind of thing. And so there's that aspect of it. There's that reason that the image has always kind of been at the back of my mind. But there's also the strictly practical aspect of it, which is the press said, well, we're going to publish this in paperback, so it's cheap enough to sell some copies, and it's going to have a black and white cover. So if you've got an image that's in the public domain and it's in black and white, we'd love to hear your ideas. And so this is both of those things.
Heterogeneous engineering at work.
Exactly. There you go.
Final question for you. What's something that you believed, thought about, either media distribution at MSNBC in particular, or just generally, when you first started this research, first started the dissertation work, that you've changed your mind or no longer believe after completion today?
Oh, let's see. I think probably the thing that I'll say here is probably it's only distribution in sort of the most contemporary understanding of the term distribution, where we're talking a lot about sort of it becoming a two-way process where the audience is always very much in where the audience is almost always kind of very visible to practitioners. And you can cite historical examples where, you know, there were sort of participatory aspects of even the oldest kind of distribution infrastructures. But as I mentioned kind of in the introduction of the book, there was this period in which particularly people who were kind of studying the way these organizations were working with technology, and lots of critics from like the Silicon Valley and the tech press and stuff like that, were looking at the way that large media organizations were kind of like reticent to adopt new digital technologies. And there was this idea that they were kind of dragging their feet and that they had disdain for the audience and all these things. And maybe some of those things are true to an extent. But I think all the people who are sort of clamoring for sort of these legacy media organizations to really just to take a page from new media organizations and basically look, you know, to just become or basically take a page from Twitter or take a page from Facebook or just kind of learn from the kind of new small mammals in the Silicon Valley how to behave. I think a lot of the challenges of that were underappreciated. And it's not just that you have an old business model that it takes a long time to transition out of, which is a thing, right? Where it's going to take a long time to figure out how to, you need your existing revenue stream to fund any new experiments. And so it's going to take a while to transition in that way. But the other thing is that when it comes to sort of your view of the audience and how you interact with the audience, there are also challenges that legacy media organizations face that new media organizations don't or do to a lesser extent when they're first starting up, right? So if you look at a startup, if you're a new startup with, you know, some name that's misspelled so it'll turn up in search results or something like that, right? Your big problem as the brand new media organization is that no one's heard of you. And when they do come to you, you know, they start using your platform and you can kind of and it's pretty easy to sort of take input at that point, right? You have a few thousand users, they start doing something unexpected, and so you create a feature that's based around like some new use of the site. It's pretty easy to sort of model yourself around the interests of your users, and the people who come to you have relatively few preconceptions about what you do to the extent that they're inventing new uses of your platform. If you are CBS or if you're ABC News or if you're the New York Times, you know, it's not unique to television organizations. everybody has an opinion about who you are and what you do. These legacy media brands, you know, that were around during the era where there were three networks in every, only three networks in every home, or only a few magazines on the news rack or newspapers that were available, like nationally or even locally. Everybody has an opinion about what they do, right? And everybody has a grudge or a thing that they think about you. And so, you know, Will Femia put this really eloquently in the book, but I can't summon his quote from memory all that well, you know, but if you think about, for example, like CBS or something like that, you know, the minute that they open a comment thread, right, everybody has an opinion on who they are and what they do. And you know, they're the people who hired Dan Rather, or they're the people who fired Dan Rather, or they're the people who, you know, who brought in Katie Couric, or whatever it is that they like, you know, love or hate about your organization. That, you know, that's all there immediately from day one. And it creates a different kind of conversation that has different challenges to managing it, from the small community that get acquainted with one another and develops a set of norms right out the gate. You know, very frequently, and again, this is a quote from Will, is there's this idea that sort of like the commenters who show up on a legacy media site are the people who are yelling at their television set and don't realize there's a person on the other end, right? That's how he put it. And I'll always love that quote. So the challenges of managing that are very different. And one of the stories in the book is of Newsvine, this social media company that, when it became sort of the community feature set for this set of legacy media properties, had to really rethink how it managed community conversations. So they had one infrastructure that was built around a particular community, and even though the technology was working just fine, when you started introducing mainstream media commenters onto it, it behaved in such a different way that there were people within the television organization who thought that it must be broken, right? That there's something wrong with the software or something, or maybe it's the news buying community, the people on this, the pre-existing social media site that had attitude problems or something like that, right? There were all these kind of like, you know, just theories tossed around about why things looked so ugly initially. And it's because there's just a whole different like set of norms and that go around or that go with commenting on these mainstream media sites. And one of the big challenges as conceived by Mike Davidson and the people who were at that company, and I think more broadly now within the media industry, is, you know, is if you know, the initial challenge of developing online communities was sort of, how do you take this group of people you know, and put them, place them in a new environment that they have to kind of orient themselves to and create a productive conversation. You know, now it's sort of how, you know, for at least when it comes to these larger, mainstream media companies, it becomes increasingly about sort of, how do you take this mass of people who already have a very strong opinion about the brand that they're interacting with, and who may not even be thinking about the other people who are reading, right, or about there being any sort of community there, and how do you fashion community in that environment with those sets of people? So the challenge of sort of producing, you know, constructive interactions with an audience is very different from the challenge, is very different for mainstream media organizations or legacy media organizations than it has been for startups. And I think that was something that I didn't fully appreciate initially, and that I think a lot of sort of the industry commentators who for the longest time were harshing on big media organizations didn't quite see out of the gate. So
today's guest has been Josh Braun. He is the author of This Program Is Brought to You By: Distributing Television News Online. Josh, thanks for being part of the New Books in Media and Communications podcast.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.